You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. And today, in celebration of the 4th of July, we're going to be talking to historian John Stauffer about his book on the Battle Hymn of the Republic. That's the song that you're hearing in the background. This is a program from the Radio Cafe Archives. Please stay with us. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Funding learning initiatives and community programs, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanl Foundation for support of the Radio Cafe. I'm very happy now to welcome John Stauffer. He's professor of English and African and African American Studies at Harvard University. He's co-author of the book, along with Benjamin Soskis, Battle Hymn of the Republic, a biography of the song that marches on. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be on air with you.
So this is a book about a song that so many of us know, the Battle Hymn of the Republic, which has about a 200-year-old history and which illustrates so many of the tensions of American history, tensions between peace and militarism, religious and secular, black and white, north and south. How did you come to write this book and to see the song as the focus for so many of those issues?
That's a great question. So I was working, I've written a lot on abolitionism, about John Brown, black and white abolitionism, interracial friendships, the Civil War era, and the Civil War. And I had long been fascinated by the popularity and power of John Brown's body, which was a precursor of Julie Ward Howe's Battle Hymn of the Republic. In fact, Julie Ward Howe rewrote John Brown's body into Battle Hymn of the Republic. It's the same tune. And John Brown's body had become, or was during the Civil War, kind of Union mascot. And so it's a song that enshrines a militant abolitionist. And I was fascinated by that, the power of John Brown's body in Battle Hymn of the Republic in the Civil War era. And then I became increasingly interested in the ongoing resonance of Battle Hymn of the Republic. And it's still popular today. It's still sung widely. It's the unofficial American anthem. It was performed at the end of the 9/11 eulogy when President Bush gives a memorial address and Billy Graham gives a sermon and the U.S. Navy chorus performs a rendition of the battle hymn at the National Cathedral. In National Cathedral itself, there are reliefs. And I realized in doing research how influential Battle Hymn has been for all different kinds of cultural and protest movements in the United States from its founding. And so I felt that Battle Hymn of the Republic, from its origins and its influences and its ongoing relevance and resonance in the 20th century, would be a way of really exploring America itself, the idea of America itself and how it's evolved and the tensions that are inherent in it. The song has been used by, has been the anthem of many groups who did not like each other. So it's the evangelical anthem of the 20th century. It was also the wobbly anthem of the 20th century. They didn't really exactly get along. It starts out as a militant abolitionist song in John Brown's body and in Julie Ward Howe's Battle Hymn of the Republic. Today, Southerners arguably like the song more than Northerners.
Right, right.
Why is that? So those are some of the questions that we try to answer in the book.
Now, the tune has stayed relatively constant since the beginning of the 19th century. Even, as you said, many new lyrics have been attached to it over the years. What are the origins of the song itself, of the music?
So the music, great question. The music begins as a African-American Southern spiritual in the South, a slave spiritual. It begins as Say Brothers, Will You Meet Us, or On Canaan's Happy Shore. And it was sung by slaves at camp meetings in the South. There are a number of examples of observers seeing slaves performing or singing Say Brothers, Will You Meet Us on Canaan's Happy Shore in a ring shout, which is very much an African-American structure. A number of observers describes slaves on plantations singing Say Brothers, Will You Meet Us on Canaan's Happy Shore. It was also sung by white Southerners as well, but the best we know is that the origins of the battle hymn as a tune, which is a simple AAB, AAAB melody, was Say Brothers, Will You Meet Us, so that it's at least as much African as it is American. And it meant different things for white Southerners and for slaves. And Canaan came to be a metaphor of the antebellum South. Canaan, of course, is a heavenly place. It evoked the idea of deliverance from sin for white Southerners without touching slavery. But for slaves, Canaan's happy shore reflected deliverance from bondage. Canaan was a heavenly place and a place in the world. And so that was the origin, and there are numerous, as I said, examples of slaves singing, Say Brothers, Will You Meet Us on Canaan's Happy Shore, and that song became popular, and it was a Methodist hymn, sung at Methodist camp meetings, and it was published in Methodist hymn books. We identified the first known iteration of Say Brothers in an 1806 Methodist hymn book, and then again in 1807. And by the 1850s, the song circulates to Boston in hymn books. And Bostonians hear Say Brothers, Will You Meet Us. They don't understand the degree to which it had originated as a slave spiritual. But for Methodists and for many other groups in Boston, it becomes popular. And so that becomes the source of John Brown's body, and John Brown's body emerges because there's some soldiers right after the Civil War in April of 1861, right after Fort Sumner. It was the 2nd Battalion, known as the Tiger Regiment. They were stationed at Fort Warren in Boston's Harbor. And in among the Tigers was a soldier by the name of John Brown. He was a Scottish immigrant, and the Scottish immigrant John Brown and some fellow soldiers formed a choral group. They liked to sing, and the militant abolitionist John Brown was one of the most famous names in America at the time, because John Brown leads an interracial army to invade the South. They take over the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry. They're captured. John Brown is tried and executed for treason and murder. But most Northerners treat John Brown as a hero and martyr. And the vast majority of Americans, North and South, see Brown as a crucial catalyst that leads to secession and war in the first place. So these soldiers in Fort Warren are forming a choral group, and one of the members, this Scottish immigrant, names John Brown, and soldiers do what they often do, which is they start ribbing or needling each other. And so they say, "Hey, you're John Brown. You can't be John Brown. John Brown's dead." And then another soldier would add, "His body's moldering in the grave." And that becomes, over a few weeks, the first stanza of John Brown's body.
And there's an aside, there's another little sad story, because John Brown, the Scotsman, died a premature death. He drowned in the line of duty.
That's right. That's right. The Scottish John Brown dies a premature death. And but John Brown's body, it becomes a Union anthem by August of 1861. So the Tiger Regiment becomes part of the Massachusetts 12th, and the Massachusetts 12th They sing John Brown's Body in Boston Common. It's published in early June, when they do so by the abolitionist C.S. Hall, and the sheet music sells out, and then the 12th goes to New York, and they march down Broadway in New York singing John Brown's Body, and it electrifies people to such a degree that in which the New York Tribune publishes the lyrics of John Brown's Body. So by the end of August, early September 1861, John Brown's Body is a Union mascot, the most popular song in the Union Army, and remained so for the rest of the war. And it coincides with Congress having passed the first Confiscation Act, which authorizes Union soldiers to confiscate slaves who'd reach Union lines, put them to work, and feed them and clothe them and pay them. They don't legally free them, but in practice, it is the first leg of the Emancipation War. In the sense, emancipation, the war for emancipation begins in August of 1861. So it's no coincidence that this song commemorating this radical abolitionist becomes the Union mascot at the same moment that Congress turns the war, initially ostensibly to preserve the Union, into an abolition war or emancipation war, because everyone knew that John Brown's Body is unambiguously an abolitionist, or John Brown isn't. Yeah.
We're talking to John Stauffer about his book, The Battle Hymn of the Republic. I was thinking as I was reading the book, I mean, it's written into our Constitution that we have no state religion, but there was a sense of the pervasiveness of religion, of those camps, those religious camps, of people's conversions, of Christian hymns. And it seems like the hymns had a kind of all-purpose use. They were songs like this one, which became a smash hit, even though it wasn't any more strictly a religious hymn.
Yeah, right. That's a great point. There's a long been what I call a prophetic tradition in American culture, meaning activists, whether it's John Brown or the soldiers who are marching and singing John Brown's Body, fighting for a cause, whether it's abolition, whether it's Union. Prophetic tradition is one in which you believe that you're acting on God's will. You believe that you know God's will, and you're acting on God's will. And that's immensely empowering, and especially in a society in which if you don't have money, if you're not particularly powerful, if you believe that you are acting on God's will, you're heeding God's will, that's immensely empowering. And it's why John Brown, it's why Julie Ward Howe, a wealthy woman, but a woman nevertheless, really invokes the biblical language and the language of God. In fact, Julie Ward Howe, how she turns John Brown's Body into Battle Hymn of the Republic, is that Julia and her husband, Samuel Gridley Howe, were both abolitionists. They knew John Brown. They had hosted John Brown in their home. And Samuel Gridley Howe had been one of the six leading funders or conspirators helping raise money for Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry. So they were intimately connected to this militant abolitionist. And Julia and her husband go to Washington, D.C. in November of 1861. Her husband is head of the U.S. Sanitary Commission, and Julia was very well trained. She had already published two books of poetry. She was widely heralded as one of America's great poets, and she had a beautiful operatic voice. And so in Washington, D.C., she and some friends witness a review of Union soldiers and Confederates attack. There's a skirmish and the equivalent of a 19th century traffic jam. And so Julie's in her carriage with her minister, her Unitarian minister, and other friends. And she starts, as a way to pass the time, she starts singing John Brown's Body. And the soldiers hear, and they say essentially, "Go girl, good for you." And her friends say, "You know, Julie, you should rewrite John Brown's Body, essentially elevate it, bring to it more elevated language. And Julia responds, I've often thought of doing so, but never received the inspiration. Well, she's staying at Willard's Hotel. She returns to the hotel, and that night she wakes up in the pre-dawn darkness, and in her account, the words had pretty much already been formed, and she scribbles out six stanzas of Battle Hymn of the Republic, the last stanza she realized is needed. And in February of 1862, she publishes Battle Hymn of the Republic on the front page of Atlantic Monthly, which is essentially the precursor of the New Yorker. And so in a sense, Julie Ward Howe suggests that she didn't write the song, God did. Much as Harriet Beecher Stowe specifically said, frequently said, I didn't write Uncle Tom's Cabin, God did. And what's fascinating about the lyrics of Battle Hymn of the Republic is that the lyrics come primarily from Revelation 14, the book of Revelation, particularly chapter 14. The opening stanza, for example, mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He has loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on. That's essentially rewriting Revelation 14. This song is impossible to appreciate and comprehend the lyrics of Battle Hymn without understanding the reference to Revelation. And what's fascinating about Julie Ward Howe having virtually memorized Revelation is that Revelation is not a book of the Bible that is usually associated with Unitarians, because it's an apocalyptic book. It describes this apocalypse in this new age. But the connection really highlights the degree to which most Americans, and especially Northerners, understood the Civil War as an apocalypse, after which this new age would be created.
Well, and that's one of the things that's so interesting about it. It has such a combination of biblical and military lyrics,
right?
And people presumably understood both of those things equally at the time when the song came out, or when the poem came out.
That's right. That's right. Americans, the Americans' understanding of their Bible, most Americans, they became literate by reading and rereading and reciting the King James Bible. That's how they became literate, is reading and rereading and reciting the King James Bible. Even if they didn't go to church, they read their Bible. And in my view, the King James Bible, regardless of your religious beliefs, among other things, it's one of the great works of world literature. If you read the King James Bible over and over again, you will become a very effective writer.
Now, the Civil War, as you say, was for so many people in the North imbued with the sense of symbolism of good and evil.
Yes.
It was apocalyptic.
Yes.
It was almost a holy war.
Yes.
And this song was its anthem.
Yes.
What about in the South? Was there that same sense of symbolism with its accompanying music?
Yes, there was. Not Battle Hymn of the Republic. Southerners hated Battle Hymn of the Republic during the Civil War, but many of their songs also, and Jefferson Davis, even far more than Lincoln, Jefferson Davis invoked God and the symbolism of the Bible and of God in their quest to achieve and remain as an independent country. And none of their songs had the endurance or the longevity that Battle Hymn of the Republic did. In fact, one of the most fascinating aspects in the research of the book is discovering that how the Battle Hymn of the Republic participated in the reconstruction of the United States after the war. Battle Hymn of the Republic is clearly an abolitionist song. It's yoked to John Brown's body. John Brown's body is unambiguously abolitionist. And Julie Ward Howe is too, although by the 1880s to 1900, especially by 1900, Battle Hymn of the Republic had become immensely popular in the South. There was a early movie in 1911 called Battle Hymn that was especially popular in the South. Southerners began to embrace the Battle Hymn, and how that happened really required the Battle Hymn to be divorced from John Brown's body. because if you read the lyrics of Battle Hymn of the Republic, God, the song is about God and freedom. God is the main character, and God is invoking freedom. And Southerners were fighting the Civil War because they believed in God, and they said they were fighting for freedom. And so it's wonderfully ambiguous enough so that Southerners could embrace the song as their own song by the 1890s, once Battle Hymn gets divorced from John Brown's body. And that happens after Reconstruction, at the end of Reconstruction, beginning in the 1880s and especially the 1890s, in which, in the quest to reconcile sectional differences and having the North and South reunite, John Brown's body gets sidelined and seen as a radical song. And from roughly the 1880s to this day, John Brown's body has been sung only by African Americans and radicals, and it's no longer been a mainstream song. So that opened the way for Battle Hymn to be reinterpreted, focus on the language. And when you read the words, the I is an I who believes in God deeply and who's fighting for freedom. And Southerners were doing that's what Southerners said they were doing. They were fighting for freedom, a different kind of freedom than Northerners, but they were at least as religious as Northerners.
It really is quite amazing that it was so embraced by the South, considering that it was the anthem of the Union during the Civil War, that
right.
It was embraced by Abraham Lincoln.
Right.
And something like that can turn around in one generation.
That's right. It was a little more than one generation, but just over one generation. But that's exactly what happened. In much the same way that by 1915, Southerners had embraced Lincoln as one of the nation's great heroes. Southerners believed that Lincoln was their best friend by 1915, as reflected by the most popular and influential movie in American history, Birth of a Nation. Lincoln is a hero. And, you know, he is the chief executive. He's the president of the United States. He's more than any other single individual probably responsible for destroying the Confederacy and slavery. And Southerners come to embrace Lincoln as their hero by 1915, much as they but a little earlier have embraced Battle Hymn of the Republic as their anthem.
Now, in the early 20th century, the song became a progressive anthem. It was part of the Union movement. The words glory, glory, hallelujah became solidarity forever.
Right.
When this happens, what of the old meanings are kept and what are lost? What happens when a song evolves in that way?
That's a great question. So it reflects the degree to which a song adapts to new circumstances. When Battle Hymn of the Republic becomes a progressive anthem, it continues to function as a reunion or reconciliationist anthem, because the Progressive Party very self-consciously sought to unite Southerners and Northerners. Teddy Roosevelt was really the head of the Progressive Party, and he actually came close to getting Battle Hymn of the Republic passed as the official American anthem. And he was unable to convince a few key Southern congressmen to do so. That's why he wasn't able to. But Teddy Roosevelt understood the importance of establishing alliances with Southerners as well as Northerners. And the other factor that is important in this time period is that Southerners and Northerners began fighting together as in the Spanish-American War, and then especially in World War I, and that helped to resolve any lingering tensions over the Civil War. So in a sense, the Battle Hymn of the Republic as a progressive anthem continued to fuel the reconciliationist sensibility of the song as a national anthem, and helped it achieve this its status as a national anthem, and in fact indeed an international anthem. The British fell in love with the Battle Hymn of the Republic in World War I when they were fighting with Americans. Winston Churchill's favorite song was the Battle Hymn of the Republic, and it was sung at his funeral in part because he learned it and fell in love with it in World War I. When it was rewritten among the Wobblies and became the labor anthem in the 20th century, A Solidarity Forever, it had very, very different connotations. I mean, the Wobblies very self-consciously saw themselves as modern-day abolitionists, as radical extremists who were fighting this major power, not slavery now, but capitalism. And their song was empowering for them. But like Battle Hymn of the Republic, the original anthem, of Solidarity Forever, written by Ralph Chaplin, retained its millennialism. So they, like the abolitionists and like the progressives, believe that they were fighting under the aegis of God. They were heeding what they understood to be God's will. And so in all of the various permutations of the song, the Battle Hymn of the Republic has functioned in many respects as America's, as a form of American civil religion. Well, what's American civil religion? It's the idea that Americans are acting out what they believe to be God's will for their country. And that's been a major empowering motive for all different kinds of movements. And it's a song that has always, in all of its permutations, at once united and divided people. It's a perfect, in a sense, it's a perfect war song or martial song, in that Battle Hymn of the Republic establishes an us versus them.
Right.
And progressives and Wobblies and abolitionists and evangelicals and all of the different groups who embrace it as an anthem understand that this is a, whether it's a religious war, an ideological war, this is a kind of war in which we have to clarify an us versus them. It's an ideal song for a nation in some sort of war. It's a song that encourages sacrifice. It's a song that in which God becomes a catalyst of social change, not humans.
It's interesting that, I mean, you point out somewhere in the book that there is a kind of structural similarity between the kind of religious camp meetings and a kind of military structure, and
right.
That hymns, whether they be martial hymns or religious hymns, are used for very similar purposes.
That's right. That's exactly right. And that's been the case with a lot of popular music throughout history. It's one of the reasons why not just Say Brothers Will You Meet Us, not just John Brown's Body or Battle Hymn of the Republic, but folk music, popular music, has always been a very powerful form of what I call protest literature, as a way of protesting certain existing conditions and seeking a resolution to it. You see it more recently in the civil rights movement. Think of all of the great folk songs that emerge out of civil rights movement, or the folk songs, the protest songs that emerge out of the labor movement in the 20th century. For the very reason that you sketched out. But I would argue that the Say Brothers, and that then becomes John Brown's Body and becomes Battle Hymn of the Republic, have been the most enduring, especially Battle Hymn, the enduring, really beginning as a folk hymn, that has become the anthem of major groups in American culture. I mean, and think about it. Battle Hymn of the Republic was the anthem of the evangelicals, it's hard to appreciate or to understand the United States without understanding the impact and the influence of evangelicals. It's hard to appreciate and understand the United States today without understanding the influence and the impact of the labor movement, beginning with the Wobblies and then evolving into the socialists and the New Deal labor unions. Battle Hymn of Solidarity Forever was the labor anthem for all these movements. The Progressive Party remains deeply influential for politicians today. Teddy Roosevelt is widely considered one of the top three greatest politicians or presidents in the United States.
Now, was there a tension between the kind of religious, we're doing God's work attitude on the one hand and the really anti-religious, secular nature of the labor movement, which was grounded in Marxism, which is fundamentally anti-religious?
So that's a great question. The answer is that the Wobbly, so that the Communist Party USA was Marxist, and it was profoundly secular. The Communist Party USA rewrote the lyrics of Ralph Chaplin's Solidarity Forever so that it would become more secular. And most Wobblies, not all, many if not most Wobblies, hated the communists because the communists represented a militaristic organization and it was wholly secular. The Wobblies were anarchists and they were deeply spiritual. In fact, the Wobblies patron saint, and this is true of the Socialist Party USA as well, the Wobblies and the Socialists, their hero was Walt Whitman. And it's impossible to read Walt Whitman without appreciating the power of spirituality. In a sense, for both Wobblies and American Socialists, they were prophets. They believed in the power of God, and they understood that a socialist revolution, in fact, Eugene Debs and Upton Sinclair and many of the leading socialists specifically acknowledge this, and that is a socialist revolution was nothing other than the materialist manifestation of Christ's second coming. Chaplin explicitly says that this Wobbly revolution in which the union will overcome the capitalism and government, the Wobbly revolution is a materialist manifestation of the second coming, so that the material is ascertained and appreciated through the spiritual, and the spiritual is understood and ascertained through the material. What's different about the American socialist and the American Wobblies vis-a-vis the European socialists and the European Wobblies is the religiosity of the American Socialists and the American Wobblies. And that's very different from the Communist Party, although the Communist Party USA was never that influential in the United States. So one of the myths of the labor movement, at least in the early period of the 20th century, is the myth that it was secular, and that's not true.
Very interesting. We're talking to historian John Stauffer about his book, The Battle Hymn of the Republic. Now, the song, as you've said, has always been embraced and sung by African Americans since the beginning, since before it was The Battle Hymn of the Republic, since before it was John Brown's Body.
Right.
And tell us about, continued, to the present day, tell us about the role it played in the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 60s, and particularly Martin Luther King's use of the song and its lyrics.
So King, it was one of King's favorite songs. It was one of the many anthems of the civil rights movement. It wasn't the leading anthem, but it was one of the many anthems of the civil rights movement. In fact, Martin Luther King Jr., in the very last speech that he gave the night before he was before he was assassinated, he ends his speech with the line, "Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord."
Yeah.
King was like John Brown, like Julie Ward Howe, like so many other activists and radicals in the United States, a prophet who was acting on God's will, was invoking God and positioning himself within this larger prophetic tradition. And when King gave his famous speech in Montgomery, to give you a sense of the popularity of Battle Hymn of the Republic. He was speaking to tens of thousands of fellow civil rights activists. And in Montgomery, he extemporaneously launches into the first stanza of Battle Hymn of the Republic. It's not planned. And he and the tens of thousands of listeners all sing all five stanzas.
Wow.
And there are very few people today who have memorized all five stanzas of Battle Hymn of the Republic. It's a very subtle and sophisticated hymn in terms of its lyrics. These civil rights activists knew that song by heart. And to this day, a group that underappreciates and knows Battle Hymn of the Republic arguably better than anyone else are African Americans. For many African Americans, Battle Hymn of the Republic remains not just a hymn, an anthem, but a prayer.
Yeah, I was thinking about it. We talked to somebody the other day. We talked to an author who'd written a book on the Trayvon Martin case, and she was talking about all the mythologies that we have in the United States of standing your ground. And even in this song, the words, "He has sounded forth the trumpet that shall never call retreat," this
right.
idea that we Americans never retreat. And that is used in so many different ways, including this stand your ground idea, which was
That's
then
right.
used against this young African-American kid.
That's right. That's right. I mean, it's one of the rich ironies in American culture is the long-standing martial language in the culture and militancy in the culture. As I said, one of the reasons why Battle Hymn of the Republic has been a national anthem is that it's a brilliant song that at once unites and divides. It creates of us versus them. And stand your ground. That term, stand your ground, it's everywhere in the song. Let the hero born of woman crush the serpent with his heel.
Right.
It's a brilliant, brilliant martial song.
And then it becomes a signature song of the Mormons and is often sung by the Mormon Tabernacle Choir.
Yes. So Mormons were, their history is very rich. You know, Mormons were under siege in the 19th century, and one of their great heroic treks was to move to Utah. That's when Joseph Smith was executed. And part of the Mormons' embrace of Battle Hymn of the Republic reflected Mormons' brilliant strategy of entering what I would call more of mainstream as in a way to prevent them from being prejudiced against and being attacked and demonized. They essentially became as middle class as the next middle class, and by embracing Battle Hymn of the Republic, it was one of the ways of them doing it. It was the same thing with African Americans. I mean, for African Americans during the Civil Rights to proudly sing Battle Hymn of the Republic, this was a time in which people widely understood Battle Hymn of the Republic to be an official or unofficial American anthem. And here are these civil rights radicals singing Battle Hymn of the Republic as their song. A brilliant move.
Yeah. Now, at this point, the Battle Hymn of the Republic seems to be embraced by virtually everybody and is used for a lot of different and contradictory purposes. It's used
yes.
at Tea Party rallies. It's used at Obama's inauguration,
yep.
the National Cathedral, as yep. you mentioned, after 9/11,
yep.
by grade school kids who are making it anti-school.
Yep.
And it seems like people want to attach whatever meaning they feel like and just use it.
That's right. That's right. And it's a song that lends itself to that because it's so wonderfully ambiguous. Because it's the narrator is being inspired by the God, especially the God of Revelation, inspired to act and inspired to realize these glorious ideals. But it doesn't spell out what those ideals are other than the vague concept of freedom. And it's inspired. God is marching on. His soul is our God is marching on. Since God is marching on, his day is marching on. There's the refrain itself, the last line, is immensely inspirational. So it's the wonderful ambiguity of the lyrics, and the fact that it withholds specifically naming what that ideal is, but rather emphasizing that one's actions are inspired by God, has been a reason for it being embraced by all these different contradictory movements.
And it leaves the reader, at least it left me, with a paradox, which is that we kind of unite when we have a song like this that in some ways can be, as you say, is so ambiguous, can be used in so many ways. But at the same time, when you delve into that song, it leaves you with a sense of a country with a history that is so divided, and
yes,
so much of that division is rooted in slavery,
yes,
that one wonders if it could ever be united.
That's right. That's right. I mean, it highlights the deep, long-standing divisiveness of the country. But at the same time, the very fact that the song has been embraced by so many different people, in a sense, you could say that Americans have been united in their divisiveness. That they accept that, and they've also been united in their prophecy, in their religiosity. To this day, it's less apparent among intellectuals and artists and writers, but in terms of developed nations, the United States is weirdly unique in terms of its religiosity. From 1970 until today, between 90 and 98% of Americans say they believe in God without doubting the existence of God, and over 50% of Americans attend religious services regularly, meaning every other week or more, which means that most Americans attend a religious service more frequently than they see a movie. And compared to every other developed country, Canada to our north, for example, all of Europe, I mean, the difference is shocking. And that's one of the other things that makes the United States truly unusual, if not unique, as a developed nation in its extraordinary religiosity as reflected in this song. So the divisiveness ironically unites them, and the religiosity which is reflected in the song has also been a way of uniting them, even though they use religion for very different purposes.
How do you understand that unique religiosity that we have?
So a main answer that virtually every religious historian has acknowledged is that the separation of church and state has been crucial to that, which is different from most of Europe, and that by separating church and state, it's required ministers and religious people to participate in a capitalist marketplace and appeal to people at a specific time, and to change the language and to change the stories, to appeal to people now or at any given point in time to appreciate the power of God or whatever religious figure you want. And that's been hugely influential. So it means that if you look at, say, any specific denomination or religion in the United States from just after the Revolution until today, you would be hard pressed to say this is the same religion, denomination, whether it's Catholicism or Methodism or Judaism or Baptism or Episcopalianism or Quakers. The religions have adapted themselves brilliantly to a marketplace, and you see it most effectively in some of the fundamentalist groups. The fundamentalists and evangelicals were especially brilliant at using technology, using televangelism to spread their word, and adapting their message and the form of their message, their liturgy, to what modern audiences.
And in that way, it reinforces capitalism and is reinforced by capitalism.
That's true. That is true. Although it's also ironic that some, even today, many religious groups who participate in that, while they participate within a capitalist marketplace and in a sense reinforce it, have ironically opposed the kind of capitalist marketplace that exists. You see it most especially among the labor movements of the 20th level Wobblies and the socialists. Many of them were deeply religious, not in any kind of an orthodox way, but in a heterodox way, that capitalism was their enemy, and yet they're using God, they're using the language of the Bible as a way to attack capitalism, and doing so in a way that participates in a capitalist economy.
John Stauffer is co-author, along with Benjamin Soskis, of the book The Battle Hymn of the Republic, a biography of the song that marches on. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for inviting me.
Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy, supporting social and emotional needs of students and teachers. Visit lanelfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanel Foundation for supporting the Radio Cafe. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.